visiting. We've been going through the books of the Bible more or less one by one. Actually, the last month or so, we've been hitting them two by two. Long story. Anyway, I won't repeat all that again, but we're up to the book of Job. And if anyone really, kids or adults, want to follow along, I have these in the lobby to take notes. So I try to follow this format as we go through. So we'll do a book and then a story, which is the other side. And yes, they look the same, but they're different. I'll just go set that aside there. Just leave that up here. yeah, we'll go ahead and get into this. So for the book of Job, of course, is one big story. So it was good to have the scripture reading that gave the big part of the story that leads into that. Get my notes here. And so we always do Bible timeline, kind of orient where we are in the story. So we left off last week with Ezra and Nehemiah, which is pretty much at the end of our timeline before Jesus, the end of the Old Testament timeline. And I skipped Esther because we did that last year, and that would be around the same time. And so we're at Job, and you might think, well, that must come after Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And it does not. We hit the end of the timeline for the Old Testament, and Job is not clearly marked as to when it takes place, but it seems very likely that it takes place a long time ago, in the time of what we call the patriarchs, which is a nice long Greek-sounding word, but meaning like the time of Abraham, roughly. So somewhere around there, maybe Abraham, Jacob, maybe before, not really sure. And I kind of forgot to bring any notes on why that is. One of the things that kind of stuck out to me as Walter was reading chapter one is the fact that it says, he was a great man of the East. Where's the East? Why didn't it say a great man of Israel or something, right? So that's kind of a flag right there. And the East usually implies anywhere but Israel. When they were cast out of the Garden of Eden, they went East. You know, the East is, we live on the East Coast, right? So to us, East is water. But for them, East is desert. East is away, as far as an Israelite reading this. And so whoever on earth wrote the story, considers Job to be in the East. And so you already get that sense that it's not in Israel. And then, so, you know, why is he a role model if he doesn't live in Israel? Is another red flag, right? And so, and you see that he, at the beginning of the story, he's good to offer sacrifices and, to God. And so again, why doesn't he need to go to a temple or a tabernacle or something? So all of this kind of clues you in that maybe this took place quite a while ago. But it's not entirely necessary to know that, just as a bit of trivia, I guess, or whatever. But so we'll start with the summary. I think everybody knows the story. I hear people describe it, even who are not religious. I think everyone knows of the suffering of Job. But he's a devout believer of some kind, whether you call him an Israelite or not, a believer in God. But he's tested by God, and he loses everything and regains everything by the end of the book, at the very end of the book. what's maybe less well known is that, you know, we usually read the first two chapters and the last chapter, and then there's a lot in the middle or something, and that's a lot of poetry. So there's these conversations between Job well, I would say conversations between Job and three other men, and then there's Elihu, another man that's random, and he just kind of speaks. Job makes his own speeches, but it's just these conversations and speeches for the vast majority of the book. And so I'm saying 38 of the 42. You might say 39 if you include chapter 3. Anyway, mostly this, right? And so as a result, in our Bibles, we put this in the poetry section. Always struck me as odd because I always thought of it as a story, but it is mostly a poetry book. And so maybe you don't think of it that way, but that's how our Bibles put it, is right next to Psalms and all the other poetry. So what makes this book special? And again, not telling you anything new here. Job is like almost literally synonymous with enduring, hardship, to the point that, we see this quoted in the, or described in the New Testament. So this is James 5 verse 11 from the English Standard Version. And it says, "Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job. And you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." And so, just kind of takes it as a granted. You know about Job, right? And how he was, steadfast, you know, faithful, even through all of his trials. So, I don't have too much to add to that. So the main characters is Job. He's in there. And he lost everything, and he was very rich. You got that impression from the thousands and hundreds of livestock and servants and things that he has, and children and all that. He's very rich, but lost everything. Less well known, right, are the three friends, and it describes them as friends. Chapter 2, verse 11, for example. But with friends like those, who needs enemies, right? So they're constantly beating him down. And, verbally, not necessarily physically, but, verbally beating him down, for, a good chunk of the book, over half and, between that and the conversations. And then the oddball is Elihu, like I say. He's just a young man, who just has this monologue, of speaking for several chapters. Toward the end of the story, read in a commentary somewhere that he's the only one with an Israelite name, which is unusual. So don't know where he came from. We really don't know where any of these people came from. So, or how they met or anything, but, there you go. This is the main characters. Other than, of course, God is in there. And the scene with Satan. if you're doing an outline, as I always say, I would, if I was taking notes, I would just stick to the red, that I have there. So as we know, the beginning is the story where he loses everything. The end is, that very last chapter is where he gets everything back, but kind of leading up to that, I would put all the chapters of 38 to 42, where God responds to Job and kind of puts him in his place and has this very long speech, a couple speeches directly from God, kind of lumping that with the ending. But that middle part is the bulk of the book, where first Job, laments, you know, which is, says, "I wish I'd never been born," basically, in chapter 3. And then you get the friends talking to him. So first, it's a lot of... So you get with the outline in one of my study Bibles. I thought it put it well. There's three cycles. So you get the first friend. What was it? Eliphaz? I've already forgotten the names. Eliphaz... makes a speech for a chapter, Job responds. Bildad makes a speech for a chapter, Job responds for like a chapter or two. And then, what was the other name? Zophar responds, makes a speech for a chapter, and then Job responds for another chapter or two. So you get that, and then you get that again in the next few chapters, 15 to 21. And then oddly, the last friend doesn't say anything in the final group. It's just Eliphaz and Bildad. I'm gonna try to remember these. I don't know why. The other one just got tired. I don't know. Who knows, right? But so that's the part. And then Job has this very long speech of 6 chapters. And then Elihu just comes out of nowhere. So that's kind of the big part in the middle. I know we're flying through this one. It is really just, to me, mostly just the story with the conversations. So I don't have as much depth to bring today. And we'll make time for the reading at the end. So, and I forgot to mention that. I hopefully was able to give handouts to those of you. This will be at the end of the lesson, but I've got that poem. Try to break it down into sections. So, so as far as unusual theological things in the book, it's that scene or two with Satan. That's odd, right? We don't see that very often. We know of the devil having his influence, and I don't know about you, I put Satan and the devil as one being. I think everyone does. I don't know of anyone that says that's different, but just to be clear, because I just switched words. we don't, you know, we know he's there, but we don't see him really as a character talking very often in the Bible. There's this chapter, there's the Garden of Eden, where he is, you know, as the serpent talking to Eve. And then the temptation of Jesus, right, which is recorded in Matthew 4 and Mark 4, is referred to as the devil or the tempter. And he's speaking. And beyond that, I don't, maybe in Revelation, but I don't think there's anywhere else. You know, we know he does speak, but it's they're few and far between. So this is one of those stories that really kind of jumps out as memorable in the Bible. So all right, so we went through that one fast. We'll get to the story in a second. If you're taking notes, and I certainly did go fast, I'll give you a second to catch up on your notes. But Job, of course, isn't a devout believer that was tested. It is a model of enduring hardship. I just wrote three friends as the main characters because their names are difficult to remember. Let's see if I got it now. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And then Elihu, the other young man that just pops up. And so the book, having that main structure of really the stories at the beginning and the end, and then all that conversation in the middle. So we'll get to this. I'd used this slide, this picture a few weeks ago, and didn't even think about the fact that I actually planned to talk about this story later. So it's a repeat. That's all right. The picture is anyway. So our story, I was going to do 2 Kings 6, 8 through 23. I don't really have additional stories out of the book of Job, because it is a story, so usually I try to pick a story from the book. But in this case, I wanted to do this because it kind of, to me, relates to this theme of, you know, when you see what's going on behind the scenes in the spiritual realm, as we saw in the beginning of Job. And so I wanted to kind of tie that into this story here. So 2 Kings chapter 6, 8 through 23. What I call the chariots of fire, with Elisha and the young servant. All right, so the backstory to this, the scene is what's so memorable, is this chariots of fire, but the real story is one of those many times when there's an invasion and everyone's scared. So there's a foreign army, army of Syria or Aram, if you have, you know, King James, for example. No, I'm sorry, it says Syria too. Well, some, I think New American Standard says Aram instead of Syria. So just know that's the same country. But a foreign army surrounds Elisha, and he's not scared. He knows that God is on his side, and we get to see why. We get to see the spiritual army that actually protects him. And so why is this story special? For that reason, because as we say, it pulls back the curtain. So we get to see at least some part of God's spiritual army that it kind of makes you wonder, is it always there? It seems like somehow it's always around, just waiting to protect us, or is actively protecting us. So I think we talk sometimes about you know, the kids might sing a song, "I'm in the Lord's army," you know, and we have the spiritual army, and we have lots of songs in our books actually about you know, the battle belongs to the Lord, and lots of spiritual army songs, and that's good. And we kind of think about that as being us, you know, as the army. And we're just going to, you know, work for God and do what's right and be good to people. And that's good. Don't get me wrong. That's really good. But what I mean by this is like an actual army of spiritual beings, that we don't even see. That's just all around us, it seems, or at least is from time to time. So powerful troop of warriors. That is an unusual thing in the story. The main characters, Elisha. So you've heard of Elijah the prophet. There's also Elisha. He's the successor to Elijah, if you aren't too familiar with the prophets. And there's a servant of Elisha. He's the one that's scared in the story. Elisha's a prophet. I don't know if I said that out loud or not. Prophet of God, a good one. He's in the northern kingdom. So, just be aware that this is not in Judah. This is at the time after the countries have split. The country has split into Judah and Israel, which is the north, and that's where they are. And then you've got two kings as the other main characters, I would say, the king of Syria or Aram, depending on your translation, which is not Israel, right? That's an enemy king. And then the king of Israel. What's funny about the king of Syria, as we'll see, is that Elisha has some sort of divine intel into what's going on in Syria. And the king of Syria just assumes Elisha's a mole and needs to be killed. So we'll see that. So there's the outline, and we'll go ahead and read the story. So 2 Kings 6, 8 through 23. Then the king of Syria warred against Israel and took counsel with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." So just an ordinary day in the life of the king of Syria, I'm going to, you know, go and do a battle somewhere. Verse 9, "And the man of God," that would be Elisha, "sent unto the king of Israel." So first we were talking about the king of Syria. There's a lot of kings here, right? Now Elisha is going to the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that thou pass not such a place, for thither the Syrians are come down." So again, somehow Elisha knows what's going to happen. He knows the plots of the king of Syria. And so Elisha tells the king of Israel, don't go that way because it's a trap. Verse 10, "And the king of Israel sent to the place which the man of God told him and warned him of, and saved himself there not once or twice." So astonishingly, the king actually listens to the prophet. At least when it concerns his own life and welfare, and avoids this place, that's a, you know, going to be an ambush or something. Verse 11, "Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled for this thing, and he called his servants and said unto them, Will ye not show me, which of us is for the king of Israel?" So he's like, how does the king of Israel keep avoiding me when I go to attack? I must have a spy in my midst. Who is it? bring him here, right? Verse 12, and one of his servants says, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. And he said, go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, behold, he is in Dothan. So I guess it wasn't a good enough answer to for someone to tell the king of Syria, no, no, there's no spy. He just somehow mysteriously knows what's going to happen. He's like, that's great. Go get him. So verse 14, therefore he sent he thither horses and chariots and a great host, and they came by night and compassed the city about. So he didn't just send one or two people to go get Elisha. He sends like an army to surround the city just to get Elisha. Verse 15, and when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, alas, my master, how shall we do? So, of course, you wake up, you see an army surrounding your city. You're like, this little scary. Elisha doesn't seem scared, but the servant is. Verse 16, and he, Elisha, answered to the servant, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. And I'm sure you're looking around saying, what are you talking about? There's just the two of us. verse 17, and Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes of the young servant man, that he may see. I think he's, I say young, I'm not even sure. I'm thinking of Elihu, of the servant man. Anyway, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man. Oh, it is young. Okay, I'm not conflating the two. And he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. So there's this spiritual vision. 18, and when they came down to him, Elisha prayed unto the Lord and said, smite these people, I pray thee, with blindness. And he smote them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said unto them, this is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom ye seek. But he led them to Samaria. And it came to pass, when they were come into Samaria, that Elisha said, excuse me, Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. And the king of Israel said unto Elisha, when he saw them, my father, shall I smite them? Shall I smite them? So Elisha's kind of led them. This army was blinded. He led them over to Israel's capital city of Samaria, like basically to the doorstep of the king. And the king's like, hey, why don't I kill them? You know, for some reason he asked permission of Elisha. And 22, and he, Elisha, answered, thou shalt not smite them. Wouldst thou smite those whom thou hast taken captive with thy sword and thy bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. And he prepared great provision for them. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away. And they went to their master. So the bands of Syria came no more into the land of Israel. So the king's just nice to him, to this foreign army, and just sends them away. Very diplomatic ending to the story. So what's funny to me is, I guess not that funny, but this is not the first scene for Elisha seeing chariots of fire. Maybe that's why he wasn't scared. So in 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 11, if you wanted to go back and read that, this is where, Elijah, yeah. Okay. So this is a scene of Elisha and Elijah with a J, and Elijah is taken up to heaven, with the chariots of fire, and Elisha sees it. And so verse 11, 2 Kings 2, and it came to pass as they went on and talked that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. So he's seen this before. then another, and you might want to just keep a hand or marker or something on that page, because we're going to read the next verse in a second. So it's another interesting thing in this story that we read is that, oh, I forgot to write the verse down. He calls them, the king calls Elisha father. which is strange. Verse 21. Sorry, I didn't write that down. Verse 21 of our story, 2 Kings 6. And, you know, we know it's not his literal father, but it's an interesting term of respect to him. And again, this actually harkens back to 2 Kings 2, the very next verse, in verse 12, where with the Elijah taken up. Verse 12, and Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof, and he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and rent them in two pieces. So, seeming that he's referring to Elijah, I don't think he's referring to God in that way. And then a really interesting parallel to all of this in chapter 13, and verse 14 is another, so it's kind of a combining of the two. So a different king of Israel, also speaking to Elisha, but he uses that entire phrase that Elisha said. So 2 Kings 13:14. Now Elisha was fallen sick of a sickness whereof he died, hadn't died yet, just he's going to. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down unto him and wept over his face and said, oh, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. So just like Elisha said in chapter 2. So it's kind of an interesting phrase. I don't know exactly what to make of it, but just a term of respect and just, I guess, you know, honor for first Elijah and then Elisha as a prophet. So I don't know. I just thought that was kind of interesting. And so again, the big elephant in the room and all this is the spiritual army in the story. That's the thing that sticks out to me. And you know, it's not just off in some distant cloud, like, I don't know about you, but the way I think of the book of Revelation or something, you know, everything's happening on a cloud somewhere, and then someday the army's going to come down. But you know, it's almost seeming like the army's around us all the time, and these spiritual beings are all around us. And we, you know, we get that sense with the devil and his army, right? We feel that he's around us all the time. So why would we, I don't know, at least why would I think it strange that, that God's army, is also, just as prevalent and around us all the time. So, but it still is surprising to me. And things like this happened a little bit, in other scriptures. So, in Joshua 5, is an unusual scene where he meets the commander of the army of the Lord. I'll go ahead and turn there. We didn't have time to talk about this when we went over Joshua, but it's such an, I guess I'll say odd scene, and just odd in the fact that there's so few like it. So Joshua 5, 13 to 15. And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with a sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord, host meaning army, I am I now come. And it's as interesting as answer. Are you for us or against us? No, I don't take a side. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, what saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so. So other times when there's an angel or something, you know, they say, no, 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 don't worship me. And he's like, no, it's okay. This is holy ground. So it's really unusual. And then, of course, you think of how Jesus says that he could call more than 12 legions of angels to rescue him. He doesn't, but he could. You know, we see hints of it, that it's out there. So, all right. Again, if you're taking notes, I'll put the recap up there and then we'll get to our poem. If you want to turn back to Job 38 and 39, we'll be reading from there. But we have more visitors than I expected, but, I handed some of you, paper of the reading, as I tried to put that into, some, organization of topics within the section. Yeah, so I'll just leave that there and think. I only had the chance to go over the notes if you're taking notes. So, again, Job 38 and 39. It's a bit of a longer reading. But it's a really, really foundational, I think, speech that God makes that just really puts Job in his place. Who do you think you are? Is sort of the theme of the whole poem. And so, God has a lot of evidence for this. So I'm gonna read off my paper, the one that I handed out. Usually I read out of King James, but I have this, nicely organized on my paper here. So I'll just read off of this and I'll try to keep up with the, headings. So first is the introduction. So Job 38, starting verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Speaking of Job, right? "Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me." So get ready, in other words. All right, so 4 through 7, he's talking about the dawn of time. He says, "Where were you, verse 4, when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Or on what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." 8 through 11, he talks about the oceans. He says, "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, 'Thus far you shall you come, and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed.'" And then he talks about light in verses 12 through 15. "Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold at the skirts of the earth, and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken." and then he talks about the seemingly kind of hidden places of the world in verses 16 to 18. "Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this." And he goes back to talking about light, verses 19 through 21. "Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern its paths to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great." So it's sarcasm. Like you could just like go to the house of where light lives and just pay it a visit. All right. And then snow and hail and wind, verses 22 to 24. "Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth?" And then about lightning, 25 to 27. "Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain, and a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert, in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the ground sprout with grass?" I guess more so the rain there. And then again to water, 28 to 30. "Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? And who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." and then he gets to like the constellations, verses 31 to 33. "Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades, or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season?" I don't know what that is. "Or can you guide the bear with its children?" I think the bear of the Ursa Major, Ursa Minor constellations. 33, "Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth?" And then kind of a summary of this first section, just of the elements of, you know, earth, wind, and fire kind of thing. Starting verse 34, "Can you lift up your voice to the clouds, that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are. Who has put wisdom in the inward parts, or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom, or who can tilt the waterskins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clods stick fast together? So in the back of that page, now he talks mostly about animals. And it's an odd break. It's not quite at, chapter 39. I think there's a few verses in 38 that kind of go with this section. So chapter 38, verse 39, talks about the food chain. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? And then now we're into chapter 39, verse 1, where it talks about animals and their, you know, and their mothers. Verse 39, chapter 39, verse 1. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? The young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. Then he focuses on a donkey, 5 through 8. Who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, to whom I have given the arid plain for its home and the salt land for its dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. So you just have no control over it, no matter how great you are. Same with an ox, 9 through 12. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on him because his strength is great, and will you leave him to him your labor? I assume meaning, you know, without a yoke to bind him, right? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? He's not going to be an independent, worker that you can just trust, everything to, right? He's just one to, do his own thing. And then the ostrich, which is kind of funny because it seems rather insulting. But I think the idea is that because the ostrich doesn't seem to have much sense, but it still survives. And so God takes care of it. 13 to 18. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but, are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with your young as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. We'll go to horses, 19 to 25. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. And then birds, finally, at the end. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out the prey. His eyes behold it from far away. His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is he. So, quite the rebuke of God to Job. Seems no stone left unturned, and there probably is actually, but very thorough, to let him know, no, there's so much that goes on in nature that you just don't even think about from one day to the next. And yet God is in control of it all. So we'll close there. And just extend the invitation. If there's any that that do need to obey the call of the gospel, that are are lost, but want to trust in a God that is the God of the universe, and can take care of you and of all of us, and does look after his children. This is a good time to come forward as we stand and sing the song of invitation.